lots of conversations about these things in ways that are happening on universities, but I think this will be a new conversation, one which will engage the things that we face in the world. And to begin with, it will be Christopher Hitchens for 5 minutes.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, by all means restrain your applause, as I was rather alarmed to see you just did. Without my asking, all praise in any case, all praise belongs to Allah. Thank you, Mr. President, for that very generous introduction. Thank you, Jinesh, for again agreeing to be my sparring partner. And I ought to say, and I do this without, I hope, any hint of unction, that ever since I began this challenge some years ago now, with my book, I've been very impressed and very touched by the generosity and the open-mindedness and the kindness, especially of so many Christian audiences in the United States, who allow me to abuse their hospitality in a way that at least I hope I can redeem by being amusing and perhaps instructive. And I've got 5 minutes, and that's the most I'm going to waste on politeness of that kind, but believe me, it was well meant. Now, glad that Socrates was mentioned so early and so soon. In Dinesh's work, it's often said that there's no more certainty that the man Socrates existed than there is, actually I think Dinesh would say there's even less, than there is that, say, Jesus of Nazareth was a real person, or the Prophet Muhammad was a real person, at least in the sense believed in by his devotees. But you see, it doesn't matter to me to prove Socrates existed. I don't need to prove that, because I don't believe that by studying his method that I can achieve bliss. I don't think it'll bring me happiness. I don't think it'll bring me salvation. I don't think I'll get eternal life from saying how amazing it is that such a person ever existed, because I personally don't think that these promises can be kept. And I also think that as gifts, they're not worth having. What I learned from the Socratic method is the only thing that really is worth having. And I say this to an audience of people undergoing, for the most part, their higher education. The most important thing of all, the ability to take the great risk, the most worthwhile risk, of thinking for yourself and accepting all the consequences, however unpleasant some of them may be, of taking that chance. That, to me, is the most important thing of all. And that is why I begin by a simple proposition: of all these so-called virtues, the one that is the most overrated is that of faith, because there is no a priori belief in which we can say we have any certainty. Indeed, all the progress that makes it possible for us to be here, for me to be speaking through this microphone, for us to be rehearsing these arguments, comes precisely from the opposite. From the realization, as Socrates puts it, that everything must be doubted, if it was Socrates, if he did it, he didn't write anything, but he's well reported. And that the only test of an informed or educated person is how much that person understands how little they know. Let me warn you, those of you who are young, that this only gets worse, or I would say better, as your education improves and increases. You'll find out there are even more things you don't know about. You'll get an even better idea of how little you know, of how little you understand. You'll get, when you study galaxy formation, a subject we didn't even know about till recently, that nobody knows very much about it. Though we do know now about our primate and mammal nature, and what we have in common with other animals through the study of DNA that Francis Collins has done so much to advance, we still don't know enough about it to be any use to us. We can't use it as we once hoped we could, or not yet, for cures. We hope that will happen, but we don't know how that will happen yet. We know that the quantum, in some sense, exists. If you make predictions based on it, they'll be right to an amazing degree of exactitude, but nobody knows what the quantum really is or how it works. And I could go on, and these are arguments from my own ignorance that I wouldn't have been able to make. I wouldn't have been smart enough or well-informed enough to be able to make these observations even 10 years ago. Now I'm so much better educated that I know so much less about so much more, or so much more about how little I know. And the one thing that's useless to me is faith. To say, ah, but there is a human sacrifice that some people say took place of someone who might have been distantly related to a deity in Bronze Age Judea about 2,000 years ago. That means that I really don't have to worry about anything. I'll live forever, my sins are forgiven, I'm saved, and all moral and ethical questions are solved. Now, this is the one proposition that has no value morally, scientifically, ontologically, epistemologically, of any kind at all. It's the one assumption that you have to discard before you can go on. Because if you will believe that, you might as well believe, say, that an illiterate Arab merchant living in a cave and unable to read or write was nonetheless able to take dictation and put it down in the form of what's called a recitation, still the Quran, in an infallible and unalterable form that is dangerous, in fact, to disagree with, and that contains all that any person needs by way of the law, ethics, morals, or interpretation. If you can believe one, you're perfectly entitled to believe the other, which is indeed a plagiarism of the first opinion. So, it is said, well, in answer to that, well, okay, we can't necessarily say it's true. We may not know that it's true. Actually, I can't see how a person of faith can make this concession. But some do. It may not be true, but at least it makes people behave better. The same, of course, could be said of a belief in Vishnu. It can't already be true. By that you mean I've got another 5 minutes. I mean I've got another minute. Or could it be said that by now anyone who hadn't got my point was never going to get it? I'll make three assertions. You'll be questioning me later, so bear in mind that these would have been things I've tried to be eloquent about as well. Religion, if you're going to say it makes people behave better, you must admit, be willing to admit, that it's just as likely it'll make people behave worse. Many of the worst behaviors indeed arise from differences about what kind of religion is the best one, which seems to make it an imperfect or, let's say, insecure source of morality and good behavior. And that in the desire for a celestial, or heavenly, or supernatural, or non-scientific authority, someone who's decided everything that you need to know before you were born, and will continue to arbitrate it after you are dead, you run the risk of having asked for a totalitarian authority, for a big brother solution, for a tyranny that is the ultimate terminus of unfreedom. Not just in this world, but in the one that you strive so fearfully to imagine. In these respects, I propose that humanity will be better off if it outgrew religious faith. Thanks very much for your time.
Feel free to take 7 minutes.
I want to say how delighted and thrilled I'm here. Christopher Hitchens and I have debated a few times now, but never before such a large and enthusiastic crowd. So we are thrilled to be here in Orlando. And I will try to play Mickey Mouse to Christopher Hitchens as Goofy. Now, in a way, it's a little bit, to me, the question that we were asked is about God. And to me, it's a little bit puzzling that we've begun by, on this note, about what we know and what we don't know, because To a very large degree, I agree completely with Christopher. We live in a world in which we know, I would say, far less than he even suggested. If someone were to ask you for definitive proof that you were alive yesterday, you can say, I remember being alive, but your memory could be faulty. Or that you are actually the child of your own parents. Or that other people have an independent existence from you. that the world was around 5,000 years ago. On all these questions, we have to make inferences based on limited data. So I would argue that the issue of God and the issue of science has the same root, which is to say, here we are, flung into the world, and suddenly we look around, and we can imagine ourselves to be the first man, and we ask two questions. Number one, how did I get here? And number two, why am I here? How did all this get here? Why is it here? Now, I would argue that science is an attempt to answer one part of that question, which is the how question. If somebody said, how did the universe originate? Science will attempt to give a description of how it happened. But science leaves the other question, which is equally vital and pressing, untouched, namely, why? Why are we here? Why is there a universe? Why is there something and not nothing at all? And I think that the inference to God is a rational deduction, no different than science makes all the time on hundreds of other issues. For example, Isaac Newton confronted a mysterious phenomenon, which is the attraction of one object for another, gravity. And Newton could say that if you have two objects, they attract each other, but he was a little puzzled about how. Because how can one object reach across empty space and affect another object? So you can describe how gravity behaves, but Newton was deeply puzzled about what gravity is. And ultimately he said, I don't know. I can tell you how it works, but if you ask me what is it, I'm baffled. Gravity, you might say, is the invisible entity that Newton postulated to explain a seen phenomenon. Science does this all the time. Two of the most exciting discoveries of our time are the discovery of dark matter and dark energy. Has anyone ever seen dark matter? Never. Has any scientific instrument detected it? Never. How do we know it exists? Because the galaxies hold together, and there's not enough matter in them to have the gravitational force for that to happen. So scientists postulate there must be some other kind of matter, unlike any matter we know, that's holding the galaxies together. Let's call that dark matter. And dark energy is postulated in exactly the same way. Something is causing the universe to expand at an accelerating rate. What is that? We don't know. Some force must be pushing it. Let's call that dark energy. If you add up dark matter and dark energy, what percentage of total matter and energy does it make up? 95%. All the known matter and energy in the universe is a mere 5% of what's out there. The rest of it is unseen. It is postulated to explain what we do see. And similarly, God is unseen, but God is the causal explanation of why there is a universe, why we are here. In other words, we know using common intelligence that something doesn't come out of nothing. The universe had a beginning. If you study physics, if you learn about the Big Bang, you will understand that not only did the universe have a beginning, space and time had a beginning. Space and time are properties of our universe. What does that mean? First there was nothing, and then we got a universe, and space and time to boot. Now, interestingly, there was one group of people, and as far as I know, only one, which is the ancient Hebrews, who said that. They said, first there was nothing, and then we got a universe. Now, the ancient Hebrews who said that didn't do a single scientific experiment. They basically said, God told me. And 2,000 years later, we discovered through science that they were basically right. So in other words, to me, God is the ultimate explanation. Science answers the question of how, but God answers the question of why. Thank you very much.
How long do I have this time? Good, great. All right.
the how, the why, the beginning, the end, all of these things are linguistic superimpositions on things we don't understand in the least. And Dinesh at least was good enough to concede that the ancient Hebrews weren't even guessing what they said. Well, he now so conceitedly says from his side, science has vindicated a guess that was made in the dark. That's not a method of any kind. It's not a logical method. It's not a scientific method. Well, suppose we start from the other end. This is all I've got time to do in 2 minutes. Why is there so much nothingness coming our way? Edwin Hubble was the first to notice not just that Newton's theory was wrong, that things are expanding away from each other at an extraordinary rate, the so-called red light shift, but that those Newtonians who agreed, all right, the universe is expanding and exploding away from itself so fast that soon we wouldn't be able to detect the Big Bang, were wrong in thinking that at least the rate of that expansion and explosion would be decreasing by now. It's not, it's increasing. It's flying apart at a fantastic rate. A gigantic amount of nothingness is coming towards us, as is, as you can see it in the night sky, the Andromeda galaxy on direct collision course with our own, but probably that won't happen, you'd be glad and relieved to hear, before our own sun swells up, destroys itself, and undergoes a heat death, which will mean that the oceans boil. And the people who watch that, or rather the organisms who watch that happening from Earth, won't be human, as has been pointed out by many scientists and astronomers. Our Earth probably has another equivalent of its existing time to go through. And the organisms that see that happen will be as different from us as we are from microbes. The belief in God has exactly no use, precisely zero explanatory value in considering these extraordinary matters and these grand questions, which, I repeat this, as those of you undergoing higher education, you have no right to close your minds to. If you say you already know, and you already know what the first cause and the last cause is, what are you doing with your education? Think about how much you have still to find out. Don't go with the ancient Hebrews.
We've heard already, and we'll hear again, from Christopher about the virtues of reason. I want to emphasize in this debate that at no point whatsoever will I be appealing to biblical revelation. In other words, I'm going to argue on the basis of reason alone, and in that sense I'm going to engage Christopher Hitchens entirely on his own ground. My argument against him is going to be that it is he who is being selectively unreasonable and applying a different standard to Christianity and religion than he applies to anything else. For example, if we were to land a Voyager on a distant planet, and if we were to see signs of inventions, art, construction, buildings, and so on, we would immediately say there must be intelligent life on this planet. There must be aliens who live here. We've never seen any of them, but it is a reasonable inference from what we do see. We see signs of intelligence, and we infer an intelligent designer, namely the aliens. Anybody who said out of hand, it's impossible that there are these intelligent creatures, they add nothing to the explanation, who created them? This would be idiocy. We may not know who created them, but they are an adequate explanation of the data in front of us, namely, signs of intelligence produced by evidently intelligent creatures. Similarly, we have a universe that is brimming with intelligence. How do we know that? Because it takes the genius of an Einstein or a Newton to look at nature and excavate the intelligence out of nature, to discover in nature these highly complex laws. And so I say, if it is the job of science to excavate the intelligence out of nature, who put it in there? So to me, this is not some kind of hocus pocus, it is a reasonable inference from what we do see. When we talk about the universe, and it's a vast, vast universe,
another,
it appears...
Another 15 seconds.
When we look at the fine-tuned universe, a universe that appears to be fine-tuned for life, we see in it the clear signature of a designer. It would be as though I were to enter the lottery in all 50 states and win every time. It would be reasonable to infer a plot. It would be absurd to say, well, that's just the way things happen by accident, because the coincidence is far too great. Thank you.
Questions is about what about Christianity, and I'm going to have Dinesh D'Souza begin, and then followed by Christopher Hitchens.
In thinking about Christianity, I want to begin by picking up a theme that Christopher touched on earlier, namely the fact that these religions are, in a sense, all in the same boat. In other words, they are all equally ignorant. In some senses, they are all equally dangerous. Well, I think one of the reasons we've seen the new atheism take off in the way it has is because it's been able to take advantage of 9/11. In other words, it's been able to take the actions of the Islamic radicals and try to use them to smear religion in general. Look, this is what religion does. I think it was Richard Dawkins or one of the other leading atheists who called 9/11, quote, a faith-based initiative. And so what's going on here, I think, is really a bogus analogy. It's true, the Islamic radicals do bad things in the name of God. That's true. But there is nothing equivalent in any other religion. For example, where are the Buddhist suicide bombers? I'm still waiting for them. There's nothing in Hinduism to compare. Christianity, where's the Christian bin Laden? Where's the Christian Al-Qaeda? Where's the Christian Hamas or Hezbollah? Where's the Christian country today run along the lines of post-Khomeini Iran? It simply does not exist. So, in the name of reason and balance, I would call upon Christopher Hitchens to disavow what I think is a specious analogy between Islamic radicalism on the one hand and all the other religions which I think are being unfairly smeared with the same brush. Now, on this business of multiple religions, the logic appears to be that no one of them can be true because you've got so many of them. And besides, we are initiated into a religion because of where we are born. In other words, most of you who are Christians are probably Christians because you were born in Orlando, Florida, or Tulsa, Oklahoma. And had you been born in Afghanistan, the argument goes, well, you might be a Muslim. That's true, but it says absolutely nothing about whether religion is true or false. Consider this. If you live in Oxford, England, you are more likely to believe in Darwinian evolution than if you live in Oxford, Mississippi. If you are born in New York City, you're more likely to embrace the theory of relativity than if you are born in New Guinea. What does it follow about whether evolution or relativity are true? No, it says nothing whatsoever about that. So what's going on here is you can say a logical fallacy, which is the presence of diversity illustrates the absence of truth. That's what the atheists are implying, and I think it's completely wrong. I want to say one thing about Christianity that distinguishes it from other religions, because in some senses I look at religions as human efforts to apprehend the divine. It's not surprising to me religions differ. Man is trying to, if you will, reach up and get a hold of God. That's not easy to do. And so you've got these competing revelations and competing utopias and so on. I do want to say one thing that sets Christianity apart from the others. And that is, in general, most religions, in fact all that I know, are human efforts to ascend up to the level of God. They're human efforts to climb a ladder, usually a ladder of rules and regulations, but a ladder of some sort to reach, you might say, the level of perfection, the divine level. Christianity is unique in that it inverts the whole equation. It says basically that man can't get up there, it's too high. The only way for this to happen, if it's going to happen, is God has to descend or condescend to the human level. So Christianity is different in that it involves God becoming, and you might say, coming down to man's level, healing, if you will, the great breach between us and him, whereas other religions think we can do it man's way. Thank you.
I don't know what it's like to be a Christian, but I would hope if I was one, I'd think of a better way of advocating it than by saying, Well, beginning by saying, at least it's not Al-Qaeda, guys. Come on, give us a break. Christianity, if we are going to argue at that level, I might add, Christianity has been found, or was found, directly compatible with membership in the German National Socialist Party. Every fascist party in Europe could be renamed. Take out the word fascism from European history and put in the words movement of the Catholic right wing, it's the same thing. You don't have to change a word. The birthday of Adolf Hitler was celebrated in the pulpit of every German church every year, every April, until the end of his disgusting regime. You want Buddhist suicide bombers? What about the kamikaze? Hirohito, the main ally of European fascism in Asia, was not just an emperor, but a god, himself a god, and in that name, and in the name of the Zen discipline of his organization, his armed forces, forced people to commit suicide by flying themselves into the vessels of Americans, some of whom can still tell you what it felt like to be on the end of that wonderful, contemplative, mindless thing. So, don't get me started. Slightly affected friend of mine used to say, don't let me commence. Now, Christianity, let's take it at its own face value. Let's pretend we believe that someone was born of a virgin, was put horribly to death by Roman imperialism, then the only progressive force in the Greater Palestine area, and was then seen around again. I don't know really of any religion that doesn't feature at least one virgin birth or at least one instance of reincarnation. It's profoundly unoriginal in that respect. But let's suppose that someone did have a virgin for a mother. Suppose I'm talking to you, and you say to me, well, your arguments are okay, as far as they go, but you lose because my mother never had sex with a man. I think, sounds like a non sequitur to me. Say, well, okay, you lose because when I die, you'll see me again. I'll be walking around, others will witness it. Still, your arguments don't sound that good to me. And they wouldn't, the truth or otherwise your arguments wouldn't be proven if it were so. After all, the gospel tells us, at the time of the crucifixion itself, the graves of Jerusalem opened, and those in them filled the streets and greeted their old friends and walked around, making it seem rather a commonplace event at that time. In that area, as is the raising of Lazarus, as is the raising of Jairus' daughter. It appears that resurrection was easier then than it's been found since. What has this to do with ethics? What is it to do with morality? I've never had anyone point it out. You could have a virgin mother, and you could have a resurrected body, and you could still be preaching the most evil things. And you could, I suppose, still also be the son of a vengeful God. But none of these things is even supposed to hang together, or has ever been alleged to do so. I'll mention a couple of things that have always struck me as somewhat discrepant. For example, what is the value of love? Another unquantifiable thing, by the way. Something even more unquantifiable than dark matter. Though we, at our peril, would say that because we can't measure or see it, it doesn't exist. Where would our lives be if we didn't believe? But what's the value of love if it's compulsory, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters? What if you're told you must love somebody? What if you're told you're under orders to love someone who is also a father who won't die and will never get out of your way, an authority figure, who will not quit, who will be at your funeral and your children's funeral, and you must love him. You must love him because you must also fear him. Doesn't this rather degrade the value of love as we understand it ethically or morally? I would submit that it does. What is the value of being told you must love others as much as yourself? You must, on pain of being found a wretched sinner. It's the terrible thing about it, the cultish, sinister thing, it seems to me, is that it degrades again the idea of love, and it makes an impossible demand, because you may not do it. You can treat everyone with the respect you hope you would get yourself. That's the golden rule. To love another as much as you love yourself and those you love is impossible. So you will always be found wanting. So there's a permanent cult of guilt and masochism and failure. And at the end of it is the road to hell. Something so cruel and so horrible that not even the Old Testament mentions it. The punishment, eternal punishment of the dead. For that filthy totalitarian idea, you have to get a gentle Jesus, meek and mild. There's no one in this hall who wouldn't be happier if they threw off this disgusting apparition. Thank you.
Well, Christopher Hitchens is certainly entitled to his opinions.
Thank you.
He's not entitled to his own facts. I think that what we have seen here is a real distortion of Christianity. For example, Christianity is not based on compulsion. All you have to do is read the story of the Garden of Eden. The basic idea is that you join voluntarily. In that sense, freedom is at the heart of Christianity. Not all religions, but Christianity. Second, I think that it is a nonsensical reading of the New Testament to imply that Christ ever said, "I'll be coming back in 3 days, guys. You're going to be seeing me again, and that's why I'm God." No such argument ever comes out of Christ's mouth or is stated in the New Testament. In fact, I would argue that simply coming back from the dead, let's say that Stan Oakes or Christopher Hitchens were to die tomorrow. I go to their funeral, and a week later I see him again. Christopher! Do I conclude? I might conclude something strange is going on, but I'm not going to start worshiping Christopher. I'm not going to say, "Christopher, you must be God." I would just assume that something very odd happened here. So what I'm getting at here is, in the name of reason, we're seeing an effort to read an ancient text that if you read any other text that way, your teacher would give you a D on the exam. At least we should read fairly what Christianity aspires to say. We can disagree with it. But to caricature it and say it's a religion of involuntary acceptance, and that Christ was making claims he never made. Now look, I want to make one other point about all this. The Japanese kamikaze bombers were not doing this out of Buddhism. According to Christopher, the emperor was a god, Buddhism posits a god, therefore the emperor must have been a Buddhist god. Sorry to correct you, but Buddhism does not posit a god, and the emperor was claiming divinity in a very different sense than Buddhism ever alleges, and the motives of the kamikaze bombers were not religious, just as the motives of the Tamil tigers in Sri Lanka are not religious. There have been lots of suicide bombers through history motivated by other factors. And so what we're getting here is an effort to apply a Procrustean bed in which everybody's diverse motives. The Hindus and Muslims are fighting over Kashmir, but no, they must be really fighting over religion. The Israelis and Palestinians are fighting over land, but let's blame it on their gods all the same. What I'm getting here is a historical distortion, an effort to put it all on the blame of religion. And that, I think, is not just a distortion of religion, it's a distortion of history.
It's available at fine bookstores everywhere, but I think there's some copies here tonight. I'll show you the chapter I have on the book, great book, Zen at War, which describes the relationship between Zen Buddhism and Japanese emperor and god worship and imperialism and the hell that begins when the secret reason brings forth monsters of that kind. It's available at fine bookstores everywhere, but I think there's some copies here tonight. I'll show you the chapter I have on the book, great book, Zen at War, which describes the relationship between Zen Buddhism and Japanese emperor and god worship and imperialism and the hell that begins when the secret reason brings forth monsters of that kind. Now, I suppose you could say that the book of Genesis that describes the Garden of Eden is a Christian book. It's considered by Christians, it's a Jewish book, to have anticipated everything they need to know. There were some early Christians who thought that Christianity would do better by cutting off the Old Testament books instead of taking them on. I think they were probably wise to think of that. But to say that it's voluntary to be born into a garden where the boss talks to you all the time and tells you what you may and may not do and specifically warns you against using your own curiosity about furthering your knowledge and says that's the sin that's equivalent to death is voluntary of a kind. I suppose you could possibly say, but it doesn't satisfy any definition of which I'm aware that is that of free will. Christianity does not say that the Son of God, having been crucified, will be seen again in 3 days. It's in 3 days that he was claimed by some, no one authoritative, to have been seen again. What he is quoted as having said is that he would return with the kingdom of God in the lifetime of his disciples. And this has led to an enormous number of stories from the wandering Jew onward that have to prove that someone will always stay alive till the end of time, so that that prophecy, so not vindicated, so absolutely crucially and pathetically disproven, can't be finally disproved. That's why the wandering Jew still walks, because someone has to be alive who was at Calvary, lest the most vain and foolish and sad prophecy ever made be shown to be what it is, as all other religions are, covered in the obvious, self-evident, for anyone to notice, fingerprints of the absolutely man-made. It's all man-made, and it shows. Thank you.
And now we have the third question, which is, what about science and reason?
Oh dear, well, I'm not ready. And I don't know much about science, and I hope that my reason is innate, but I'll say this much. It isn't, as some people maintain, or some of us, the new atheists, who, by the way, I heard described as, what was it? The old ones were dead and irrelevant as compared to me. I mean, I'm a lot nearer to being dead than I was when I wrote my book. But I hope no nearer to being irrelevant. The two things, let's hope, are not the same. It's said of us and of our distinguished atheist predecessors that we think that science and reason are not compatible with religion. That's not really true. I mean, to put it negatively, Isaac Newton, who was in his time the greatest ever scientist, believed that if you're a Roman Catholic, you're a supporter of the Antichrist. If you believed in the doctrine of the Trinity, you were a votary of the devil. He practiced alchemy. He several times set fire to his rooms in Cambridge. He was such a devoted believer in alchemy that he kept a furnace going all the time, trying to transmit base metals into gold, and was greatly more interested in finding out what the original measurements of the temple had been. I thought there was much more truth to be found there than in any of these theories of gravitation. So you can very easily be a man of science and evidence and reason and still be, because you will be, what you are, namely an imperfectly evolved primate, a raging crackpot. Alfred Russel Wallace, who is accused by some, and I think actually quite fairly accused by some, of having done a great deal of Darwin's work for him, possibly of being the man whom Darwin was the most afraid to acknowledge, lest he would have to acknowledge more than he liked about the evolution and separation and discrete nature of species. Why it is, in other words, you don't find kangaroos anywhere, only in some places, and of course never in the Bible, because the Bible didn't know there were marsupials, but never mind that. And accidentally, because he studied this in Indonesia, came across a theory that's very new to us. It's almost less than a century old. The self-evident theory of continental drift. Alfred Russel Wallace was mainly happy when attending a spiritualist seance and rapping tables and trying to get burblings from the beyond. You can go on like this with distinguished scientists all you like, and you won't run out of examples. I guess those are my two favorite ones. And the great Stephen Jay Gould, from whom so many people in our own time learned so much about evolutionary biology, decided to negotiate this like a good American pluralist with a respect for multiculturalism and pluralism, and say, well, science and religion are non-overlapping magisteria, as it were. They deal with completely different things. This isn't really true, in my opinion. I think there is a radical incompatibility. And it's of a philosophical kind, not a scientific one. You either believe that you are here because of the operations of evolution by randomness and natural selection, combination of the two. But it makes not much more sense to ask why are we here than to ask why are cats here, or why are falcons here. Or you believe that we are in some sense not just the products of, as Dinesh has, not, I think not very plausibly argued, design, but we're also the objects of design. Now you have to understand that anyone who makes either assertion in your hearing, and again I'm talking to people who predominantly still undergoing their higher education, anyone who says that we are either the products of, let alone the objects of, a design, has yet to produce one scintilla of evidence that would stand any kind of peer review in any kind of journal with any pretense to call itself scientific. They have, in other words, all of their work still ahead of them. So, Dinesh, you may as well take your shovel and start now.
I think if you are trying to address the issue of design, there is a foolish way to go about it that becomes a kind of straw man for atheist rebuttal. To see what I'm getting at, it would be a little bit like this. If you were trying to figure out who wrote Hamlet, I would make an argument from design and say, look, Hamlet has a plot. It's got a narrative, it's got complexity, it shows all the signatures of design. I may not know who wrote it, but someone wrote it. Christopher Hitchens says, no, we don't need to infer a designer, even though we have a plot. In fact, let's do like Hamlet, let's look around the castle in Denmark. In fact, let's search all of Denmark and say, wait a minute, we don't see William Shakespeare. Therefore, he must not exist. All we see is the characters in the play. Well, the point is, God is a cause of the universe in the same way that the author is the cause of a book. You can infer the existence of the author from the plot and complexity of the book, but you're not going to find the author in the book unless he chooses to write himself into the plot. So what I'm getting at here is, design can be inferred at two different levels. Now, let me say a little bit of a word about science and take a different tack here, because very often when we talk about science, Christians get attacked for making the argument that is called the God of the gaps. In other words, you find things that are unexplained, the original cell and its complexity, consciousness, morality. And in a sense, the atheist goes, well, you find something that science hasn't explained, a gap, and you attribute that to God. In other words, you find things that are unexplained, the original cell and its complexity, consciousness, morality. And in a sense, the atheist goes, well, you find something that science hasn't explained, a gap, and you attribute that to God. And for the atheist, the gap is a kind of a little nuisance. In other words, science is going to come along around the corner and fill this gap, and pretty soon we won't have to worry about it anymore. I want to try to show you why this is a very, not anti-religious, very unscientific way to think. In the time of the Ptolemaic universe, you had a lot of gaps. Ptolemy's theory couldn't account for the motions of the planets. And so there were efforts to fill these gaps by making up epicycles. But it took the genius of Copernicus and later Galileo to see, wait a minute, this isn't some irritating gap, some little lacuna of knowledge. No, the whole idea is wrong. We have to change the underlying assumption and we get a deeper comprehension of reality. Similarly, in the Newtonian universe, which had been verified through the entire Industrial Revolution, it predicted a lot of things with great accuracy. There was a small gap. The planet Mercury in its orbit deviated by a very tiny percentage from what Newton predicted. A gap. And a lot of, you might say, atheists of that time went, well, this is nothing. This is minor. A tiny gap. In other words, we're going to be figuring it out with conventional science in no time. It took the genius of an Einstein to see, wait a minute, no, that so-called gap is a clue that something is wrong with the entire Newtonian understanding of space and time. A complete reformulation is required in order to get a deeper understanding of reality. So what I'm trying to get here is a lot of our atheists who claim the mantle of science are actually, you might say, pilgrim scientists. They're not themselves scientists, but they borrow the authority of science to use it as a battering ram against religion. In fact, their own attitude is deeply unscientific and in some senses, deeply irrational. Thank you.
And now, we have rebuttals. And you are to begin.
We're looking for maximum,
please.
Okay. How long is it? Can it be as long as Dinesh?
You lie.
No.
I have a snarl better than that.
Okay, well, here's one thing I do know a bit about, which is textual criticism. That's how I know, for example, and put as near as I can satisfy anyone, prove, say, that the Quran was not dictated by God, but was thrown together by primates. And the same would be true, as is now conceded by almost all schools of Christianity, about both the Old and the New Testament. So when it comes to Hamlet, I can not prove, I don't have to prove it was written by somebody, as Dinesh weirdly suggests. I might make a puzzle out of that. But here's how I would proceed. I would say, well, if it's written by someone born in Stratford-on-Avon, who died on the 23rd of February 1616, I know this much. He'd have had to know about a certain episode in Danish history that happened not before that date, not after that date. Otherwise it wouldn't work. The same would be true of the stories of Macbeth and many others. Now, I've done that, and I also that he understood English really quite well, and probably had at least some knowledge of Latin and Greek. But I couldn't with certainty go any further than that. And if I met someone who said, well, I think it's the Earl of Oxford, because the Earl of Oxford spent so much time in Italy, seems to have understood the Renaissance there, seems to have been to Verona, to Venice, to Florence, seems to have understood just a little bit more than Petrarch. I could only say, well, it's true that we don't have any evidence Shakespeare went to Italy, but we do have a lot of evidence that the Earl of Oxford died before that date, and that therefore he can't have written Othello. It's therefore it's a matter of not what you think, ladies and gentlemen. But it's very much a matter of how you think. And inadvertently, at any rate, my time's going up, I would say that Dinesh has underlined and illustrated that distinction very deftly at his own expense. Thank you.
One of the striking things about this argument and this debate is I think you'll notice that as the debate unfolds, Christopher tends to shift ground ever so subtly. So for example, I was arguing...
I have to keep up. Oh, sorry.
I was arguing that if you are faced with a complex play like Hamlet, it is reasonable to posit a playwright. The play didn't write itself. Monkeys banging on typewriters didn't produce this. Somebody intelligent wrote it. Now, notice I didn't say who. You would have to correctly infer the qualities of the writer from the play itself. So Christopher shifts ground, unable to contest that. He says, well, now let's debate who was the writer. Was he actually the Earl of Oxford? Was he the Stratford guy? I didn't get there. I'm simply saying if we look at the universe, and it's quite a universe, the guy who did it probably would have to have a lot of power. If he was not omnipotent, he would have to be close to it. Second of all, if the universe is in fact fine-tuned for life, then in some sense, whoever did it, and we still don't know who it was, would have to be concerned in some sense about us. Why? Because he rigged the rules in such a way that we could be here and contemplate the universe that is before us. When you come to the historicity of Christ, which Christopher has alluded to a few times, I don't think you would find 2% of living historians of the period who would deny that Jesus Christ existed. Christopher has gotten a, I don't know who he's been reading, but he's gotten this sort of crackpot idea that in a sense, this is all guesswork and made up. Well, the truth of it is you may debate the miracles or the resurrection, but here you have an event that is as well attested as just about any event in the ancient world. How do we know Caesar crossed the Rubicon? How do we know Alexander the Great won the Battle of Gaugamela? How do we know that Socrates walked the streets of Athens? The level of testimony using a uniform historical standard. That same level of testimony affirms that there was a man, Christ, who walked the streets of Jerusalem, who made a lot of converts, who became very unpopular with the authorities. They killed him. His disciples thought they saw him again. They initiated a massive movement that essentially converted over time, first a large part of the Roman Empire and then much of the world. All those events would be inexplicable if it was all made up. It makes no historical sense at all. And if you apply this kind of logic to any other historical event, Socrates didn't exist because the two people who wrote about him, Plato and Xenophon, were disciples. They liked his work, so they made the whole thing up. Most historians would laugh at you because while they may have exaggerated the achievements of Socrates, I don't think that there's a living philosopher in America who asserts that Socrates was fiction.
You have 30 seconds to contemplate what question we're going to ask the other person, and is it acceptable you begin?
Sure.
All right.
But can I ask that someone, when we move to public questions, asks me what I think about what Jeanette just said?
Did I get that?
Okay. Thank you. Yes, actually, I don't have to think about that long. I know what I want to ask him. It's predicated on the last thing that he said.
No, please go ahead and do that first.
Sorry?
Take your 2 minutes and do that first.
No. I'll ask you a question. I'll stick to the rules. I will. But I'll just clear my throat by saying... I have a reputation to live down or up to or something. The reason I'm asking you this, my dear, is the following. Because I think it's extremely dangerous that you would say that the fact that something acquires mass support and great momentum among the masses means that it must be grounded in historical fact. Because I don't see how in that case... There are enough people undergoing higher education here to make it unnecessary for you to finish the thought. So what I want to ask you is this. You know my view, which is not only that religion is false as a philosophical proposition and very dubious as a historical one and void as a moral and ethical one. Would you rather I stayed the way I was or that I became a person of faith and declared that I believed in the return of the 12th Shia Imam? Would you rather, in other words, I was an atheist or some other kind of believer, non-Christian? And do, but by all means, feel free to give your reasons.
Yes, I'll answer your question. I want to address the point you started out with, and that is, in history, you do have to explain the facts on the ground. So, consider Islam. That's a very good analogy for us to test our thesis. If somebody were to say that the revelations of Allah are fictional, fine. But if somebody were to tell me that the Prophet Muhammad never existed, and the four original caliphs, Omar, Uthman, Ali, were all made up, none of them existed, then historically we're faced with a great puzzle. Something happened in the 7th century, what the Muslims call the miracle in the desert, but the truth of it is, where there were just Bedouins before, something got started that became very powerful, penetrated into North Africa, India, took over Italy, parts of Spain, and ruled it for 700 years. The historian has to explain these facts. So which makes more sense? That there was a prophet, and there were caliphs who followed him, just as the tradition says, and as Islamic historians have recorded over the centuries, are they all lying? Similarly with Christianity, something happened, a lot of people were killed by the Romans because they professed a belief in Jesus. If they made it up, all they'd have to say is, gee, guys, we were just kidding. It worked for a while. What group of people, not one or two, but by the hundreds, would go to their deaths for something that they knew to be a fiction? See, historically, now, to answer your question about Islam or atheism, I think
by the way.
And really, I must say, this is quite a choice you're giving me for your own future. Let me say that I feel a lot safer debating you as an atheist. So.
And now, I'll never forget that, by the way, you have an opportunity to ask him a question as well, and if you need a few seconds to think about it, feel free.
In life, there's a lot of uncertainty. Nobody knows what's going to happen when we die. Neither of us have been to the other side of the divide. And therefore, both believer and unbeliever have got to consider the possibility of being wrong. I might believe and discover that I was mistaken. You might not believe and discover that you were mistaken. Have you ever had any serious doubt about your atheism? And if so, what caused you to have that doubt?
Good. If I'm allowed a little throat clearing as you ordered yourself, just on this question of faith, and your stubbornness on it, that I didn't say that the people who went to their deaths as Christians were knowingly saying, I'd like to be tortured to death by the Romans for a hoax or for a fraud. I have no doubt, I have no right to doubt, that they did believe it. Just as I have every reason to doubt that every religious martyr, sensible face, has thought that they were going to a reward. I simply say that the very strength of that fanaticism helps to unconvince me of the likelihood of it being true. And actually, they didn't convert the Roman Empire. A Roman emperor became a convert to Christianity, and it's been a state religion ever since, probably very much to its moral and other kinds of detriment, and that's just as much a historical fact. Why you picked the Rubicon, I don't know. That it is certainly not true that we know the date of the birth of Jesus of Nazareth in the same way that we know the date of Jesus, Julius Caesar's arrival in, say, England, which we know exactly. There's no agreement out of any of the testaments of any of the dates that govern the supposed life of the alleged Jesus of Nazareth. I didn't say I didn't believe in it. The existence of such a person. So much elaboration has been undertaken around it that it's very unlikely anyone would bother to have fabricated it in whole cloth. But you may not describe it as an event in history. Now, to my own doubts, they're very easy to phrase. What if I was to take Blaise Pascal's wager? Where he says, what have you got to lose? If it's true, you get eternal life and salvation and so on. If it's not, you're exactly the same annihilated corpse as you're going to be anyway. Well, now, I always thought, as well as this generally very hucksterish tone, some carnival barker tone of this, hey, how can you lose, man? You know, come on, take my wager. There's something, as well as that, that's not moral about it. The inducement is somewhat sick. What it says is, I worship a God who wouldn't know that this was your motive for believing in him. My deity would rather take someone who says, hey, sounds like a no-lose wager to me. Have you got any mortgages I should be taking out? Any underground swamp stock? He won't know that I only believe in him on a bet, because it will benefit me. And that my honest doubts, my sincere conviction that there is no such person, would be rewarded by him for their honesty with eternal punishment. He'd say, well, so now you're here,
You offered a perfectly good inducement to believe in me, and you said no, and now I'm going to hurt you. What's moral about Pascal? Hands up. Anyone? Huh? What's moral about that? I say nothing about its truth. So here's my answer. If I turn out to be wrong, I will first say, as Bertrand Russell was invited to say in the same conditions, I can sometimes imitate his accent. He said, "Well, O Lord, you did not supply us with enough evidence." That might do as a holding action. I think my next one would be to say anyone can make an honest mistake, and I'm particularly proud of this one.
Well, you can see why people enjoy coming to events where they appear. I find it to be one of the most interesting conversation that they have when they're in debate, and when they are thinking about what they put forward, you can actually take a look at their books as well. And let's remember, as you think about it, don't forget to take a look at God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, and Dinesh D'Souza's book, What's So Great About Christianity. Now, as we go forward, we're going to open it up for questions, and I was able to secure some questions from the number of people who are here this evening, and so I thank you for doing the work of taking the time to submit these questions, and I'm going to direct them to individuals, and then you have 2 minutes for a response. And so that you're going to see an opportunity, even after this debate, to go look at the websites related to what they do and what they talk about, and I encourage you to do that. And one will make sense to you, and the other one will not make sense to you. One you will choose, and the other one you will deny. You'll do it perhaps the other way, and you have the benefits and the consequences. Now, question number one for Christopher Hitchens from Chris Davis, who I believe is here tonight. You have mentioned the historical record of leaders who claim to be Christian committing atrocities. However, how can you consider that a valid measuring stick, since a-religious nations under leadership like Stalin have accounted for tens of millions of deaths of their own citizens?
I understand the question very well, and it's usually asked by people who don't know anything about Eastern Orthodoxy. I do not know that Stalin maintained, as Russia has always maintained, the state church that praised him. He took great care and trouble to keep on his side, and don't know that to this day the Russian Orthodox Church produces icons with the faces of Stalin and other great Russian nationalist dictators. They have to be Russian, by the way. They can't be Georgian or Chechen or anything else on them. And this is a very old history that goes back to Tsarism and to the idea that there is a holy Christian special character to the Russian people that is best expressed when it can't be done through serfdom, through dictatorship, slavery, and other means. There's nothing secular about Joseph Stalin's, let alone atheist, about Joseph Stalin's dictatorship, which was one of witch hunts, show trials, inquisitions, heresy hunts, and all the rest of it. For Mr. Davis's question to be a valid one, and to say, I show you what theocratic dictatorships from fascism, Hirohito, the Inquisition, the Russian Orthodox serfdom, and the rest of it are like, and now you contrast, you give me the non-theistic counterexample, that person would have to come, Mr. Davis would have to come to me and say, here's a society, we can point to it, that decided to teach its children and its citizens that the main people worth studying were Lucretius and Epicurus and Galileo and Spinoza and Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine and Albert Einstein, and that society fell into immorality, slavery, bankruptcy, and war. And then we'll have a level playing field for this discussion. But so far, we haven't hauled humanity far enough away from the horrible temptations of religion and absolutism to make that comparison.
Question question to...
So the question is, is there any rebuttal or none at all?
I hadn't really thought about that. You have 1 minute.
Fine by me.
Okay with you?
We'll do the...
Hang on a second.
How about the 2 minute
answer? This is now a very novel debate. We now have a rebuttal on the simple question, please.
My rebuttal is just an appeal to applying a fair standard. If you're going to hold the Muslims responsible for bin Laden, if you're going to hold the Christians responsible for the Crusades and the Inquisition, why? Because Torquemada professed to be a Christian and carried out things in the name of Christianity. If Christians bear some blame for that, it seems only fair that regimes that do terrible things in the name of atheism, in the name, in other words, of creating a new man and a new utopia, divorced from the shackles of traditional religion, be held accountable for those things. Stalin saw himself as an atheist, as did a whole line of Soviet dictators, beginning with Lenin. And so to then say, well, gee, but you know, the Tsars had their own secret police, and there happened to be an Orthodox church. Stalin really got the idea from those guys. And by the way, Mao was born a Buddhist, even though he renounced all that and embraced communism and atheist ideology and killed tens of millions of people in the name of this atheist ideology. No, we still get to blame the Buddhists because they were really behind it. What kind of argument is this? If you're going to hold Christians responsible for the crimes of Christianity, let's hold atheists responsible for the crimes of atheism.
But you say in the name of, and there's nothing that was done in these cases was done in the name of atheism. It was done in the name of faith and in the worship. To trust in someone who is in one case a seminarian and in the other case, as you say, a Buddhist. You have to compare like with like. Show me a secular regime that admires the philosophy and ideas that I've been putting forward this evening that degenerates for that reason.
I'll show you.
Otherwise, you have to accept everything, which you haven't, by the way, up till now. You had not accepted what I'd said about the faith-based and nature of, and the alliance with Orthodox and official Christianity of, fascism and National Socialism. And since you didn't decide to take that on before, I think you must agree you have to take it on now.
If you look at three regimes, Pol Pot in Indochina, Mao in China, and Stalin in Russia. Now,
the ones I wasn't asking you about.
The ones that
have... you've already spoken about.
No, because you asked me to demonstrate that they actually were acting based on atheism. You're acting as though they were tyrants who happened to be atheists. I'm going to show you that their actions were based on an atheist ideology. In other words, these were professedly Marxist regimes. All you have to do is crack open the collected works of Marx to see that religion is a kind of drug that blinds you from social injustice. Marx says, in a sense, that the communist revolution can't come until religion is gotten rid of. And these professed Marxist regimes act based on that ideology. So what more do you want?
You have one more opportunity.
We have to answer this
type of debate.
Yeah,
you got the new atheism?
Yeah.
All right, please.
It's amazing the things that people believe people said, like Dr. Johnson never quite said, depend upon it, sir, man, when a man knows he's to be hanged, and so forth. Here's what Karl Marx says about religion. Anyone can look it up. It's in the introduction to his Critique of Hegel's Philosophy of Right. He says, religion is the heart of the heartless world. It is the sigh of the oppressed creature. It is the spirit of the spiritless situation. It can be even compared to an opiate for the people. Criticism, he goes on to say, has plucked the flowers from the chain, not so that men may wear the chain without any consolation, but so that they may break the chain and cull the living flower. But so that they may break the chain and cull the living flower. That is as different from the idea that he said religion was a drug as it's possible to get in any statement, philosophical or rhetorical. I'm one of the very few people to have been to North Korea. Undoubtedly the most pitiless version of Stalinism, Stone Age, stone-faced Stalinism ever to have come onto our planet. It's the most horrible place I've ever been in my life. It is an entirely faith-based state. The leader of North Korea is addressed by Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kim Jong-il, by our president, not as Mr. President, because he isn't the president. The president of North Korea is Kim Il-sung, who's been dead for 20 years. It's a necrocracy. It's a thanatocracy. It's a mortalocracy. And you'll notice it's a father dead and a son who rules in his place. It's one short of a trinity. Everyone, every day, worships the divinity of this dynasty. It is a completely faith-based system. There isn't a word of Marx available in any of its bookstores, or of Lenin, or anyone else. It is another Asian theocracy. And if you claimed that it was socialist, you would be accepting it at its own best claim, instead of condemning it for what it is. A hateful tyranny based on slavery and on the undying worship of a worthless figure. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. And now this is a question from Ryan to Dinesh D'Souza. Voltaire once said, quote, "If there were no God, it would be necessary to invent him." Doesn't the notion that belief in God developed over time to reduce fear of the unknown provide a simple psychological explanation of God's existence that is much more likely than what you suggest?
The explanation of religion that attributes it to fear of the unknown would, or alternatively, another explanation equally powerful and often argued, this was Sigmund Freud rather than Voltaire, wish fulfillment. We don't understand the world. We wish there was a better world. We wish we could live beyond death, so we make up religion. The question you have to ask is whether the religions that are said to be made up satisfy this human problem. For example, let's take for a moment the idea of wish fulfillment. I would like to believe that there's a place where you live forever, there's no suffering, there's no death. And this would explain why a group of people may have come up with the idea of heaven. Heaven satisfies wish fulfillment. But what does not satisfy wish fulfillment is hell. Why? Why would you make that up? That is far worse than any human problem we encounter. If we're trying to get away from fear, why add the ultimate fear of eternal separation from God? We're not reducing our fear, guys, by coming up with something that is far more terrifying than diabetes or looking out in the dark and hearing thunder. So when you look at the Abrahamic religions, you simply have to ask, if this is your diagnosis, Mr. Freud, you must be a pretty lousy doctor. Because the remedy doesn't meet the problem. In fact, it makes the problem worse. Jews and Christians, and in fact, anthropologists studying ancient religion, study the religion of the ancient Greeks. Does it look like wish fulfillment? The idea of everybody going to a dark underworld called Hades, far worse than anything in life? Read the Odyssey. When Achilles is confronted in Hades, he goes, "I would rather be a poor shopkeeper or a poor farmer than to be down here." The point I'm trying to get at is a simple anthropological look at religion shows that in no way is it a mere construction to satisfy wish fulfillment, or simply a way of trying to get away from fear of the dark.
I'm preempting someone's question. I just quickly want to say, one of the reasons that it's a pleasure to do this is that it was in front of a debate sponsored by the King's College in New York, where I first heard Dinesh make this point and realized that it was a highly brilliant riposte to what I would call vulgar Freudianism. And you have to think only of the next phase, however, to see one of the objections one could possibly make to it. In other words, what we wish, when we say wish thinking, or wish, we think about the child, we think about praying for a pony, or for a secret friend, or something of this kind. But remember, not all of our wishes are innocent, or nice, or happy, or beneficial. Indeed, what Freud helps us to understand is that even among children, some of the things that are desired are unpleasant. Some people, for example, want to be unfree, want to live under a dictatorship that will tell them what to do. It's their desire. They're afraid of being free. They wish for a father who never goes away. They won't get one, but they wish they could have one. They certainly wish to see other people punished horribly. They may not want to go to hell themselves, but they sure want other people to do it. Tertullian, one of the early Christian church fathers, said when a bit stumped for why will heaven be so nice, couldn't think of many reasons, couldn't offer the Quranic inducements that were later available, he said, well, you can always go and look down into hell and see the people you don't like being tortured forever in a lake of eternal pain and fire. So it's right that we say that we should beware of what we wish. And when we understand that what we wish for, because we are animals, because we are primates, because we are created sick and only by religion ordered to be well on pain and punishment, that yes, we may wish for horrible things. And so that the element of religion that is wishful need not be a wish for something benign. Don't run away with that idea. Thank you. And so that the element of religion that is wishful need not be a wish for something benign. Don't run away with that idea. Thank you.
We have time for a couple more questions. This question is from Beer Butt Chicken. That was the email address. Are you here? Raise your hand so that we can all. Beer Butt Chicken. This is to Dinesh. Why won't God, Allah, Buddha, Energy, Universe, or whatever it is called, won't heal amputees when there are so many claims of miraculous healings all over the world? Why aren't the amputees getting their limbs grown back out? For you, Jeanette.
I think that Veer Bhatt and I could have a long conversation on this one. And my sympathies go out to his stump. But his question actually is an embarrassingly easy one, and I think he's giving undue privilege to the amputees, because amputees, after all, have life. If I'm missing an arm, I still got the rest of me. There are lots of people who die at a very young age. You have children who have cancer, for example. And so the amputee is chosen as a kind of colorful analogy. But I want to point out something very interesting about this. There was a recent study I read, a study of two groups of people. One is paraplegics, and the other is lottery winners. In other words, people whose lot in life is dramatically improved. I won the lottery, yay! And people who plunged into a desperate situation. I was walking around normally, and then I lost my legs in an accident. And the interesting fact of the study was, it was studying what is sometimes called the hedonic calculus, the level of happiness. And the authors say that when you win the lottery, your immediate reaction is complete elation. You're super excited. I won the lottery. But if they come and visit you a year later, and they measure your actual level of happiness, self-described, it returns to about the level it was before you won the lottery. And why? Because you've moved into a bigger house and you've gotten better things, but you've also gotten some new problems. Some people who you didn't know have shown up claiming to be your relatives. You're facing some lawsuits you didn't have before. You made some stupid decisions with your wealth that you didn't count on. That may be not so surprising. More surprising is the study of the paraplegics. And that showed the identical phenomenon on the other side. The immediate reaction of I lost my legs, cataclysmic, horrifying. And that's the reaction that those of us who are not paraplegics immediately put ourselves in, as if we were to have the accident ourselves tomorrow. But when the authors interviewed the paraplegics a year later, and asked them, what's on your mind, being a paraplegic? They go, no. What's on my mind is, you know, the special at Denny's, $3.99 breakfast. What's on my mind is getting to the movies. I want to take my kid to school. In other words, an amazing return to normalcy, both on the upside and on the downside. And what does this teach us? I mean, what it teaches us a little bit is a lot of our so-called knockdown, drag-on arguments, well, we think we have settled the debate. What about God and those amputees? If you actually were to ask some amputees, hey, is your life not worth living? Would you rather not have it at all? In other words, if your life is a gift from God, are you still on the plus side of the ledger, or are you on the negative side? And if the amputee goes, well, you know what, it was terrible when it happened, but I'm pretty much back to normal now. I take pleasure in things in life. The point I'm trying to get at is, if we believe that our lives are a gift from God, I don't think we have a strong case against God when he's given us everything to say, well, yeah, but I'm still missing a finger. I'm still missing my right arm. Why? Because I drove recklessly or while I was drinking beer and a train hit me, or somebody else's recklessness caused me to lose my arm. So I'm going to blame you, God, because you did it. God didn't do it. Someone did it. You did it, or somebody else did it to you. So the point I'm trying to get at is these, it seems to me, are examples of pathetic human efforts to escape problems that are due to others or society or ourselves and blame the one person who deserves no blame, namely God.
Sorry, I just have to do this. First, I have to say it's terrible there are people who can't absolutely anything. Second is that Dinesh is maybe not his fault. Didn't understand the question that I'm sure the beer butt artist. Which is this? Miracle healers and shamans and prophets and sons of God and others claim to have raised people from the dead, cured leprosy, cured blindness, cured diseases that can't be seen because they're on the inside, but it's never been noticed of any miracle healer that they've made someone who lost a limb grow another one. Surely, that was the plain meaning of the question. But there's a very good reason why that's so. Because that sort of thing would be very testable, and that's why it would never get done. It's testable for the rest, see under David Hume. For the rest, you could also read, which I recommend, Dinesh is very good at opening with it, Emil Durkheim, in his treatise of great, also unbeliever on suicide, unbeliever on religion, his book on suicide. He says, about religion, he says, religion doesn't make the Jewish people invented their own religion. On suicide, he says, it's surprising to notice how any great disruption in your own life or the life of society can instill you with thoughts of self-destruction. And this may not be a terrible loss to yourself or your family, but it could also be any great shock or surprise, including, as he says, the sudden inheritance or acquisition of a fortune. But these are all perfectly secular points, as is the very obvious one, that there has never yet been a miracle worker who can grow another limb, and there won't be. Thank you.
We have 1 minute, and then I'm sorry to say that we're going to close this evening with a few comments.
I'm a little underwhelmed by the discussion of the amputees, because it seems to me that now Christopher is saying that there's something unique about that kind of ailment, that if a limb were to grow out, that would be somehow more wonderful than, say, a blind guy regaining his sight, or a dead guy coming back to life. In other words, the Bible makes all kinds of claims of testable miracles.
Except that one.
Except that one, and I don't think it's because the butt guy wasn't around at the time to assert it. In fact, I think that a close look at the miracles shows what the purpose of a miracle is. When, in other words, in general, a miracle is always aimed at spiritual healing. The purpose of healing the blind guy, I mean, you could always say, why not heal blindness? And the point of the healing is a sign of spiritual regeneration. So the miracle is performed, but for a spiritual cause. And I think that's the answer to the question at the deepest level. These miracles are not, if you will, Christ-playing doctor, but rather they are Christ engaging in his spiritual ministry.
All right, thank you very much.